Hello, this is Debbie again. It is the last Wednesday of September 2016, the 28th. I'm reading from the Decatur Herald and Review E-Edition, starting with an education topic, Richland Students Make Their Mark by Chris Lisbardi, an H&R staff writer, Decatur. An extended delay in a construction project at Richland Community College has led to an opportunity to create a highly visible outlet for student expression. Since early September, students and other visiting campus have been invited to color on the temporary wall separating the Mueller Student Center with the stalled construction space for the future student access. The headline in the print version says Richland's Many Colors. The headline on this one says Richland Students Make Their Mark, and the picture indicates it is truly a colorful and people that I would consider artists actually drawing on this wall. This is not scribbling. It is art. It's been a sign of the time. Sign of the time, said Tracy Withrow, Richland's marketing coordinator, who helped to develop the idea for the project along with the theater professor Michelle Stevens and local artist Amy Rankin. Coloring on a wall is one of those things you're told not to do growing up. What we're saying now is go ahead and do it. Coloring has become an increasingly popular activity among adults, so Withrow said the project was based in part on that trend. We added a coloring page in the student handbook, Withrow said. It's so popular this year. Brianna Houston and Darian Lipson were among those in recent weeks adding their part to the wall. It's very creative, Houston said, and it gives us something to do. The wall has become a collection of phrases, tributes, artistic expression, and artistic expression, although it's filling up, space is still available for more to be added. It's a good way to show how diverse people here are, Lipson said. The project has gotten students involved on campus in a new way during what has been an active start to the fall semester, said Jason Brooks, vice president of Richland Student Government Association. The wall has brought a lot of activity, Brooks said. We've been looking for ways to reinvigorate the student body. This gives us a voice. The longer the wall sat blank in such a high-traffic area, Withrow said, the more there seemed to be a need to give the area more character. Markers are set on a table for anybody passing by to use, although Withrow said some people have brought their own writing and drawing tools to use. We knew this had been up here a while, Withrow said. This gives them a chance to have fun with it. Richland officials aren't sure how long the wall will last, with plans moving back onto track for restarting construction of the building intended to consolidate offices for student services into one spot. Offices were scattered with anticipation the construction would be completed in a more timely fashion. Richland has used its $1.175 million share of the project to start construction last year before it was caught in the state budget impasse. After it was among the projects included in the June 30th budget agreement, the Illinois Capital Development Board recently released $4.2 million in funding for the project, clearing the way for restart plans to proceed. A meeting was held earlier this month with the contractor to discuss what is needed to restart construction. An exact timetable hasn't been established, said Greg Florian, Richland Vice President of Finance and Administration. He said the condition of the framework has deteriorated while it remained unenclosed. We don't have the new schedule from all the contractors, Florian said. We're scheduling a building analysis to find out how much damage has been done. Changes to original plans are being considered to keep expenses in line, as crews are being asked to justify any cost increases from the delay. Florian estimates a start date about November 1st, with construction expected to last 6 to 8 months, with the onset of winter being a factor. He said that estimate would likely allow the center to open by late summer. The weeds are starting to be knocked down, Florian said. It won't look like a ghost town much longer. Withrow knows the wall won't remain up forever, but she's among those hoping the artwork can be preserved, possibly even incorporated into the layout of the new Student Success Center. It's changed the space, Withrow said. It's hopefully not going to go away. Pictures of the changes have been taken and posted on Richland's social media pages, so Withrow said, at the very least, a record of how it looked and developed can be kept that way. The top of the wall says, "Make your mark." And they did. Next to crime and courts, three more witnesses placed Chatham at murder scene. This is by Huey Freeman of the H&R staff. Decatur. Anthony L. Chatham did not want to testify against his older brother. So when he took the witness stand, he responded to the question from a prosecutor on where he was the night of March 10, 2013 by pleading his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Assistant Macon County State's Attorney Kate Kurtz told Associate Judge James Coriel that Chatham would be granted immunity so that his testimony could not be used against him. But Chatham, 47, was still reluctant to testify, responding with one-word answers to questions from Kurtz, who asked him about details, what he did with James J. Chatham, 49, the night that 20-year-old James Nate Johnson was shot to death. On the second day of the bench trial of James Chatham, charged with three counts of first-degree murder, Anthony Chapman was the sixth eyewitness to place his brother at the scene at the time of the shooting, the second-floor apartment at 1114 North College Street. Anthony Chatham, who was driven to the near Northside residence along with his brother, was initially also charged with first-degree murder. But after he explained to police that he was not directly involved in the shooting, he became a witness instead. He acknowledged that he was at a girlfriend's house when he received a late-night phone call. Then he was picked up in a vehicle in which his brother was riding, driven by his brother's girlfriend. They stopped at a liquor store on Grand Avenue. Then the two men were dropped off near College Street residence. The College Street residence. Anthony Chatham testified that James Chatham knocked on the door to the upstairs apartment as he remained outside talking to the male resident who answered the door. During testimony, he was dressed in striped jail jumpsuit like his brother's because he's serving an 8-year prison term for being an armed habitual criminal. "I did not see my brother with a gun," Anthony Chapman testified. He answered affirmatively when Kurtz asked him if he was upset with James Chatham after the shooting and he had told someone that his brother ruined his life. "I was pissed off at him," Anthony Chatham testified. "They got us on the news every 15 minutes. When Kurtz asked him about a statement he'd made to the police detective after he was apprehended, he denied that he'd said that. "Your Honor, I'll play this video to impeach this witness, Kurtz said. She proceeded to screen a clip from a police interview of 3.5 years ago. In the video, Anthony Chapman says James walked into the apartment. They pushed the door shut, and then I think shots were started. Detective Adam Jarouse asked him, "When was the first time you saw your brother with a gun that night?" "When that door was pulled shut," Anthony Chapman replies. After seeing the video, Anthony Chapman testified, "I didn't see him with a gun." Kurtz reminded me he told the detective otherwise. "I guess so," he responded. To further jog the memory of the witness, Kurtz read aloud the testimony he gave to a grand jury on March 20, 2013. "You said whoever was in there behind the door pushed the door, then my brother up and got to shooting," Kurtz said. In the grand jury testimony, Anthony Chapman said his brother was kicking at the door and shooting at the door at the same time. Anthony Chapman testified that after the shooting occurred, he ran back to his brother's girlfriend's vehicle, which was parked nearby. Then James Chapman also ran toward the vehicle. They both got in it, and she drove away. Two more of the occupants at the apartment that night also testified that James Chapman entered about 11 p.m. right before the shots rang out. A woman in her 30s testified that she knew Johnson, who hung out in the neighborhood and came over just like everyone else did. She was in the bedroom just across the hall from the one Johnson occupied with her boyfriend and two female friends. "Were you using drugs at that time?" asked First Assistant State's Attorney Nicole Kroenke. "Yes, crack and cocaine," the witness said, adding she'd been using crack cane all day. There was a knock at the door, and her boyfriend went to answer it. Her bedroom door was open, but she wasn't paying much attention as to who entered the apartment. "Didn't see anybody. I heard gunshots. I looked. They were like this, holding a gun," she said, holding her arms instead in front of her hands together. "Somebody was shooting. I couldn't see the face of the guy." She said she heard three, maybe four shots, then a pause, then more shots, maybe five or six. "It was all coming from that person," the woman testified. After two or three shots, she fell forward and went into a closet to hide. She heard the man she believed to be the shooter tell another man who'd been in the living room that he shot Johnson because that white boy did something to his son, she testified. She said she recognized the shooter's voice. It was the man she knew by his nickname, Jams. She then identified him as the man sitting at the nearby defense table. She said she had known him for 10 to 15 years. After the woman heard the sound of someone running down the stair, she believed the shooter was gone, so she went to another bedroom to see who was hurt. I seen Nate, and he was crunched up against the entertainment stand. He was crunched in the corner up against the wall. He was sitting up. His eyes were open. She asked if he was okay. He did not answer. He was not responding to me, the woman testified. He never was responsive. He never said anything. I grabbed him. I was sitting on the floor, and his head was basically in my lap. She called 911. The 911 tape was played in the courtroom. He's been shot. He's been shot. He's been shot, the distressed woman says. How many people are hurt? The woman began, who do you know who shot him? Send someone now, the woman said during a short wait. Meanwhile, on the stand, the woman cried and dabbed her eyes with a tissue. Is the person who shot him there? Did he just drop in? The dispatcher asked. Hurry, 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 hurry. Then she adds, he's gone. The trial resumes at 9 a.m. Today at Macon County Circuit Court. End of that article. Next front page article. Same day registration on pause. Judge halts same day voter registration at polls. This is by Sophia Tureen, an AP writer. Chicago. Voters in highly populated areas of Illinois will have fewer options to register on Election Day this November after a federal judge on Tuesday temporarily halted broader registration rules that Republicans call unconstitutional. Judge Samuel Durr Jagerson's move means there'll be no same-day registration on November 8th at individual polling places in mostly urban areas like Chicago. Voters instead will have to go to the major county or election jurisdiction offices. The judge's last name is spelled Derr-Yegiayan. Yegiayan. Durr Yegiayan. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan's office immediately filed appeal Tuesday. Wider questions about the constitutionality of the Democrat-led legislators' 2015 expansion of same-day registration linger before the court. More than a dozen other states have changed voting and registration rules in place for November, something election officials in Illinois and elsewhere warned will create chaos the night of the high-stakes presidential contest. Illinois rolled out Election Day registration with a 2014 pilot program that required authorities to offer same-day registration in at least one location. Voters took advantage with long lines seen in Chicago. The following year, lawmakers made it permanent and expanded it, requiring highly populated areas to allow voters register in their precincts on Election Day. Roughly 110,000 people did so in the March primary. Republicans sued in August, arguing that the poll-level registration rules created an unfair and unequal system because voters in less populated and GOP-leaning areas of Illinois didn't have equal access. For example, a rural voter might have to travel longer to register at a clerk's office. The judge agreed with the Republican congressional candidate from North Central Illinois and the county party committee who brought the lawsuit. While it may be true that the polling place registration option can assist voters in certain populous counties, that option cannot be provided at the expense of lower population counties, thereby decreasing their political representation in Illinois, the judge wrote. The application of this legislation favors the urban citizen and dilutes the vote of the rural citizen. His preliminary injunction was handed down without explanation during a brief hearing, stunning election attorneys and voter access groups who rifled through the 13-page order outside of the Chicago courtroom looking for clues. State Board of Elections General Counsel Ken Menzel said it was surprising as he plans for the election, which is 6 weeks away, are well underway, and same-day registration was allowed in the primary. The jurisdictions are going to have to scramble to figure out how to accommodate these people, he said. Due to the temporary halt, the city of Chicago will have to go back to what it did in 2014 when there were five locations for voters to register on Election Day. That November, hundreds of people waited in line past the close of polls, leading to frustration and delayed results. Overall, the change will impact voters in 21 of Illinois' 102 counties and five cities: Chicago, Aurora, Rockford, Bloomington, and East St. Louis. Chicago's Board of Election Commissioners spokesman Jim Allen said rules have already been posted and materials printed for November 8th. At this late stage, this ruling creates chaos, he said. Macon County, with a population of just more than 100,000, will be affected. Within the ruling, County Clerk Steve Bean said same-day voter registration and voting would be available on Election Day, but only at the clerk's office. The ruling is not expected to impact grace period registration and voting. Unless the ruling is overturned on appeal, Bean said they will prepare the judges and to not worry about dealing with same-day registration and polling places. They will probably make a lot of election judges happy, he said. His office will be ready for an influx on Election Day as well. We may have to change how we lay things out, he said. We've had a few hundred come into the office in the past to register on Election Day. Now we have to expect up to 1,000 in office on top of having some polling places here. Some clerks said politics was a motivator for this lawsuit, with similar debates over voter access rippling nationwide. Cook County Clerk David Orr, a Democrat in a county with poll-level registration, called it a thinly veiled partisan effort to disenfranchise voters. The lawsuit was argued by the legal arm of the Illinois Policy Institute, a conservative-leaning group that Governor Bruce Rauner has donated to. The state's first GOP governor in a decade also has brought people affiliated with the Institute into his administration. The law expanding same-day registration was approved by a Democrat-led legislatively and signed by then Governor Pat Quinn, a Democrat who lost to Rauner in 2014. Rauner declined to comment on the case Tuesday, telling reporters in Springfield that he supports increasing voter access as long as it complies with federal election law and keeps integrity in the system. Jacob Hubert, a Liberty Justice Center attorney representing the Republicans, dismissed the notion that it was political, saying the government shouldn't make it harder for some to vote. The judge's order restores a level playing field for this election, Hubert said. End of that article. Going on in more election stuff, political rules out the window this year. This is by Dan Petrella, the Springfield bureau chief for the Herald and Review. Springfield. Illinois voters who aren't quite sure what to make of the current election season aren't alone. They have good company in former Republican Governor Jim Edgar, who's no stranger to political campaigns, having been first elected to the Illinois House in 1976 before going on to win four statewide races for Secretary of State and Governor. But whether it's the race for the White House or races for the State House, there are factors at play this year that haven't been seen in anyone's lifetime, Edgar said Tuesday during a luncheon discussion in Springfield hosted by the nonpartisan Better Government Association. The event, which also featured Christopher Kennedy, a former chairman of the University of Illinois Board of Trustees, who's been mentioned as a potential 2018 Democratic candidate for governor, was titled, quote, Elections 2016, Candidates, Chaos, and Consequences. I wish we could have this after the election. I would sound much more intelligent about how the election was going to go, Edgar said, drawing a laugh from the crowd in downtown hotel banquet room. On the presidential level, Republican candidate Donald Trump, whom Edgar said he won't receive his vote, has thrown out the rules of political decorum in his campaign against Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton, the former governor said. In Illinois, Edgar added, current Republican Governor Bruce Rauner has changed the political landscape by pumping more than $20 million into the state GOP, and that total is likely to grow with contribution limits now lifted in the comptroller's race, thanks to a $260,000 loan from the husband of Rauner's appointee, Leslie Munger, to her campaign. Munger faces Democratic Chicago City Clerk Susana Mendoza. Quote, Governor Rauner has provided more money than I've ever dreamed would be in Illinois politics, unquote, Edgar said, now and continuing the quoting. Now the Democrats, Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, has always been pretty good with raising money. Nothing compared to what Rauner's injecting into this election, and what impact that's going to have, I don't think we know yet. Edgar said the money his party is spending to defeat downstate Democrats might not be money well spent, noting that Republicans have tried for years unsuccessfully to use Madigan's unpopularity against them. For his part, Kennedy agreed with that assessment. I think people like State Senator Gary Forby, a Democrat Benton, and State Representative Brandon Phelps, Democrat Harrisburg, are so well known there Kennedy said. They have a personal relationship with voters. It's really difficult to move on that. Forbes facing Harrisburg Mayor Dale Fowler, and Phelps is up against Jason Kaiser of El Dorado. With voters more likely to cast straight party ballots than in the past, Edgar and Kennedy are also agreed that having Trump at the top of the ticket could hurt Republicans in chances of winning the support of women in Chicago suburbs, whose votes would be crucial to the GOP picking up legislative seats in that area. If voters do split their tickets, however, Browner's money may provide a boost to Republican candidates for state House and Senate seats in the suburbs, where Browner's more popular than he is downstate. It's going to be kind of Browner's money versus Browner's record, he said. Without a state budget in place nearly 2 years into Browner's term, neither Edgar nor Kennedy had much positive to say about his record. As he has for the past year, Edgar criticized Browner for not making balancing the state budget his top priority and instead tying budget discussions to changes in workman's comp laws, term limits for elected officials, redistricting reform, and other items on his, quote, turnaround agenda, unquote. The most important things facing the state of Illinois is to get a balanced budget, Edgar said. Everything else pales compared to that. The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment. In response to similar comments in the past, Browner has said he's focused on the future and reforming the state, not critiques from former office holders. Well, Browner talks of the need for reforms to give businesses confidence to invest in the state. Kennedy said he's seen the ongoing budget turmoil have the opposite effect. He's overseeing his family development of a piece of land along the Chicago River known as Wolf Point. Investors often ask, why should we invest in the only state that doesn't have a budget? Kennedy said. It's rattling people, he said. It's taking a state budget problem and turning it into a statewide economic crisis. As for his own political ambitions, Kennedy said it's too early to talk about 2018. He said he's focused on helping Democrats win across the state this year. End of that article, and the end of the articles on the first page of the e-edition. In local news, more good budget news for Decatur schools. School budget now stronger, say the headlines, by Valerie Wells from the H&R staff. Decatur. The Decatur Board of Education heard more good news on the budget at its meeting Tuesday. A month ago, Todd Kovalt, chief operational officer, told the board the district should receive $2.4 million more in funding this year thanks to the state of Illinois funding schools at 100% of the general state aid amount, in contrast to the prorated funding of the last several years, as he presented a tentative 2016-17. His estimation proved correct, he said, as he presented the final budget for a vote on adoption Tuesday. In addition, some of the expected expenses have been reduced since his first presentation, giving the district a budget that should be solidly in the black this year. I'm hopeful we won't have the painful process of budget reductions this spring, Kovalt said. The next challenge the board will face, Kovalt said, is that nationally there's a teacher shortage, making some positions difficult to fill. The board approved a month-to-month contract extension for interim co-superintendents Michael Dugan and Bobby Williams, while a search for a permanent superintendent is underway. Director of Student Services Lawrence Trimble gave the board a report on enrollment figures, which are traditionally taken the 12th day of attendance. Counting preschool students, 9,115 students are enrolled this year, a drop of 24 from last year's 12th-day figures. Several buildings have seen fluctuations due to high mobility in the district, he said, and three schools have classrooms that are over the cap. In kindergarten through second grade, the classroom cap is 24 students, and in grades 3 through 6 is 27. Baum and Dennis have one classroom each with one student over the cap, and French Academy has a kindergarten class with two more students than the cap. With the elementary school pods, when a classroom is over capacity, students are moved to another building in the pod that has room. And if all classrooms at the grade are at capacity, the students move to a magnet school that has space, Trimble said. Some building boundaries contain fewer children than other buildings, and in addition, kindergarten numbers were higher than anticipated this year. Student Services is working on registration and transportation planning changes based on the information they have gathered to streamline the process and resolve issues more quickly. Board member Fred Spanas discussed the Discipline Action Committee's meeting, which was held on Tuesday morning, in efforts to update discipline procedures in line with recent recent changes to state law regarding suspensions and expulsions. Because the committee is part of the Decatur Education Association's contract, alternative education is probably not part of their responsibility, said board member Alita Graham, a former president of the union. Board President Sherry Perkins asked for a copy of the contract language regarding the committee to be provided to the board before any decisions are considered about further efforts. End of that article. Continuing in education with kind of a fun article. Johns Hill kindergartners visit Oka Valley Orchard. Another headline says, kids ripe for learning. Apples. This is by Valerie Wells again. Sullivan, Johnny Appleseed's birthday was September 26, and what better way to celebrate than a visit to an apple orchard? Johns Hill Magnet School kindergarten teachers take their students to the Oka Valley Apple Orchard every year. They've come out here for at least 15 years, said Jennifer Mitchell, whose parents, Jim and Linda Bailey, started the orchard with 100 apple trees when she was 8 years old. I think it's great to educate them. A lot of kids and even adults don't understand where apples come from. They don't even know they don't grow at the same time. We don't pick them all at the same time. They don't get that experience to know how to pick one and where they come from. Today, the orchard boasts 1,500 apple trees with 30 varieties, 300 peach trees, 21 pear trees, and 6 plum trees. Do you think we like fruit? Mitchell asked the little ones. As a veteran of these tours, Mitchell knows that if she lets the kids ask questions, she'll be answering them all day. So instead, she asks them questions. Meredith Potter knew a lot of the answers, especially when it came to apple blossoms and their proper colors of pink and white. Mitchell has a giant wood apple blossom that is the wrong color that she uses for her talk. Then, when Mitchell asks what it's called, when bees carry pollen from blossom to blossom, Amina Naqvi coined a new term for it. Apple blossom pie, she said. I like that, Mitchell said, chuckling. Kindergartners study the life cycle of apples as part of their Common Core learning standards, teacher Diane Assay said. Students learn about apples' life cycle because that's something they can relate to. And for a lot of children, getting out into the country and seeing things grow is a new experience. Then this is a real-life connection, as Say said. We've read about it, we learned about it, and now the real-life connection is coming here and seeing the orchard and picking apples and seeing how they make apple cider. Kids were allowed to pick 4 apples to take home after Mitchell showed them the proper twisting technique. A lot of parents came along to help out, and they took home apples, too. The students watched the sorting machine work, learned how apple cider is made, observed a hive of bees behind glass before a snack of apple donuts and apple cider. And then a few briefs. Fatal I-57 accident, a semi-truck driver died early Tuesday when his driver drove off Interstate 57 near Effingham and overturned, throwing him from his vehicle. Decatur, Fort Daniel closure. Fort Daniel Conservation Area east of Decatur on Fort Daniel Road will be closed for road repairs within the site Thursday, September 29th, tomorrow. It's scheduled to reopen Friday, weather permitting. Decatur school candidate Beth Creighton has announced her candidacy for the Decatur Board of Education. She's a faculty member at Millikan. The consolidated general election is April 4th. Decatur, Biggest Loser alumni. The Biggest Loser winners, Roberto and Luis Hernandez, will return to their alma mater Saturday for Millikan University's homecoming celebration. Decatur, Adult Education Week. National Adult Education and Literacy Week is September 26th to October 1st and highlights programs for adult learners who need to improve basic reading, writing, and math skills and obtain a high school equivalency certificate. Decatur Energy Assistance. Decatur Macon County Opportunities Corp is accepting appointments for low-income home energy assistance from 7 to 9 Friday at the Decatur Civic Center. And that is the end of part one of the Decatur e-edition on Wednesday, September 28th, 2016. This is Debbie saying talk to you soon.